and strength and hope with us, we have Darren.
Hi, everyone. My name is Darren. I'm an alcoholic. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's nice to see so many familiar faces. Although I have to admit, I had to ask directions on the way in because I have not been to this meeting since it was in this space. So that dates me a little bit, I guess. It's been here a while, I've heard. I'm out in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn. That's where I go to meetings. I think in 2005 I decided I quit Manhattan meetings. I was like, I've had enough. And so I'm in Williamsburg. We have plenty of AA meetings out there. And I see a few of you out there from time to time. So anyway, I'm just honored to be here. It's a great pleasure to be back here. I used to come here regularly, I think in maybe 2003 or 4, and accost people at the diner afterwards and talk about service, AA service. So it was sort of like an unpleasant conversation that two or three people knew they were going to get, you know, stuck being hammered by me after the meeting. So what can I tell you? I had my first drunk on a half day in junior high school. It was one of those like awesome holiday weekends where you get out of school at like 11:15 in the morning. Your parents are still working. And I had this plan with my friend Zach, and I don't remember me and Zach like sitting down and drawing up the plan. I just knew that my job at 11:15 was to ride my bicycle home to my mom's house and get the only bottle of alcohol left in the house after my dad left during the divorce. And it was just this cheap bottle of champagne sitting in the, you know, pantry. I'm not sure how I knew exactly, you know, what alcohol was left in the house, but I knew it was there. And I went and I got it. And I put it in my backpack and I rode my bike over to Zach's house. Zach's parents lived in this big suburban home. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So all this takes place there. So I ride over to his kind of fancier neighborhood and they have this big house. And his parents are also gone for the holiday weekend, and his older sister's watching us. We're seventh grade, so we're probably 12. And we sneak into his bedroom with the bottle of champagne, and we kind of, you know, get the thing wrangled open. It's totally warm, and we just crack it open and pass it back and forth. Like, we're just standing there, like, passing this bottle back and forth. We tip it up, hold our breath, close our eyes, and just chug down as much of this warm champagne as we can drink, and as it goes into our faces and, you know, just expands into our faces, so we're just like kind of chugging down. As soon as that's gone, he sneaks out and he comes back with this ice cold beer, and I was like, Zach, where'd you get the beer? He's like, oh, my parents have a special refrigerator in the garage to hold all the beer. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. Because in my house, there was no more alcohol after my dad left. My dad had been a prodigious drinker, a binger, a disaster, and my parents got divorced. I mean, it's a pretty awesome drunk story. My dad's not in AA, so I'll go ahead and tell it for him in brief. He was chaperone of myself and my brother and like 30 other kids going from Michigan into Ohio to Cedar Point. It's like a Six Flags kind of a place. So it's like a three-hour drive out of state, and my dad's one of the chaperones for these two busloads of kids. And, you know, long story short, whatever, my dad gets hammered at this place, and that when it's time to leave at night, he's not there. And so we all have to get on the bus by ourselves and go home. And so that happened like on a Saturday night, say. And we don't see my dad until the following Thursday, right? And so apparently he was like, got drunk, wandered off, got into a scuffle with a police officer, ended up in jail for the weekend, had his court date that Monday. Paid his fine or whatever, and then like hitchhiked back to Michigan Tuesday, went to work Wednesday, right? And then like shows up Thursday night like, what? Like, no big deal. Anyway, so my mom had been in some therapy and some Al-Anon, so she was like, she kind of lined up her best kung fu move, and she was like, get help or this marriage is over. And my pop, like the drinker he was like, see you later. So, anyway. With him went all the booze, and you know, I had a sip or two with my pop. You know, he would always send me to the fridge to get the beer during the ball game or whatever, and I would crack it open and try to drink as much as I could before handing it over, thinking, you know, hoping he wouldn't notice. But I'd never had my own drink until Zach and I were there in his bedroom, and we're drinking this ice cold beer the same way we had the warm champagne. We just close our eyes and hold our breaths and tip it up and just try to chug it as fast as we could. And after a couple of beers, I guess we were feeling a little braver. We went to try to find the older girls. His older sister and one of her friends were babysitting us or whatever. And so I don't know exactly how it happened, but pretty soon we were all in the country kitchen of the suburban home, and the older sister's setting up these shot glasses, and she's going into the other room and coming back with like a bottle of, you know, a bottle of booze of one kind or another and pouring us up these shot glasses. And I've seen people drink from shots because, you know, I spent a lot of time in bars with my dad as a kid. So we used to go every summer. We used to drive this motorhome down to Florida to go scuba diving. But, like, we would park the motorhome, like, in the parking lot of a bar. And, like, right, we would maybe go scuba diving, like, one day or something. And then the rest of the time, it's like I'm, like, playing Zaxxon in the bar, like, while my dad's drinking with these guys or whatever. So I'd seen it, you know, out of the corner of my eye. I knew kind of how the older guys drank. So when the shots come up, I kind of know what I'm supposed to do. You know, I take mine and I pop it back, and I kind of keep my eye open and make sure I'm doing it right. And the older sister pours us up. I think we each got four shots. And then you know, things start to get a little hazy. I start going into my first blackout. Pretty soon, the older sister and the friend are gone. Me and Zach are playing the stereo really loud for, like, we played like one punk rock song super loud, jumped on the furniture. And then we were like, just decided to sit like across from each other in two chairs next to the liquor cabinet, and we just pulled out bottles of booze and handed them back and forth and tipped them up and closed our eyes and chugged them down as fast as we could. And it was awesome. It's like to drink exactly the way I wanted to drink in the presence of, you know, more than enough alcohol. And it wasn't like I was trying to drink a certain way. I wasn't trying to impress anybody. I wasn't feeling particularly lonely or particularly happy. I wasn't trying to be anything. It really feels like, looking back on it, like I was acting naturally in the presence of a quantity of alcohol. And pretty soon Zach was gone, and I was too drunk to ride my bicycle home, so I sort of stumble in and out of a blackout up to this local strip mall. And I remember like kind of like coming to in this candy aisle of the store, kind of trying to figure out how long I'd been there, looking around to see if anybody was looking at me funny. And then I wandered down to there's a public library there and a little bench across this mini mall thing. And so I got really tired, so I laid down on this bench. And this the next thing I know, it's like my ears turn on before my eyes are turned on, and my I hear these people asking me these complicated questions, and I hear myself saying like yes sir and no sir. And when my eyes get around to opening, and there are these six police officers there trying to figure out why this kid's on the bench, and I had some ID on me, so they just sort of took me out, and they were going to take me home. And when we get out there, there are these cop cars and a ambulance and a big fire truck, and I was like, wow, like, what's happening? Is the mall on fire or whatever? And they're like, no, you're happening. Like, the homeless lady that usually camps that bench thought you were dead and called 911. So that's how the cops got there. So they just took me home. I throw up all over the bathroom floor. My brother cleaned it up apparently while I was sleeping off my drunk. When my mom gets home that night, it's now nighttime. She comes home and she's like, comes in and is like, what's going on? And I, you know, wake up still drunk, and I'm like, all like yes sir and no sir to my mom, because, you know, in my mind, an instant ago, I was just talking to six cops, right? So I'm all like yes sir, no sir, and my mom freaks. And I didn't know this, but as you know, at that time, obviously, but later it became clear that in the 20-something years that my parents were married, in fact, they met when they were like 15 or 16, right? So my mom knew exactly how my dad drank when he was 15 or 16 years old, and then had gotten married to him in their early 20s and stayed sober, or stayed married into their early 40s. So she saw his whole trajectory of drinking. And apparently through that period of time, there had been many, many nights where my dad would come home late or confused or otherwise weird, and my mom would ask a simple question about where he'd been or what he was doing, and he would say things like yes sir and no sir to my mom. So on the occasion of my first drunk, my mother sort of has this experience as some kind of Al-Anonic spiritual experience or something, right? Like, where she realized that all those nights of her youth where my father would act this weird way, she now realized was because my pop was somewhere drunk talking to cops at some point in his night or whatever. And as a result, you know, that was my first drunk, right? So, like, as a result, that was the only free drinking I ever had. It's the only drinking I ever had that was full of joy and wonder, where I didn't know that I was going to get in trouble, you know? Like, that's why I describe it in such detail to remind myself sort of how natural it was to drink a quantity of alcohol. And that's really the way I continued to drink. But then from then on, I always knew I was going to get in trouble. And that was mostly fine with me. I really never had access enough to drink more than about once a month. I would save my allowance, and I would sort of get your allowance. I was that guy who kind of put the deal together. I knew a few of these homeless guys in my town who would, if you had enough money to buy two bottles, they were pretty reliable about, like, coming back with your bottle. So I was, like, at 12 and 13 sitting in an alley sometimes, like, with a drunk homeless man, you know, because it's sort of disrespectful to leave immediately once they give you the bottle, you know? So you kind of got to stay there and have a few. So I was that guy, that kid. Whatever. So, like, that went on for a while. I smoked pot whenever I could get it. I took pills that I didn't know what they were, that my friend down the block I drank with, whose mom was a pillhead, so we would just steal her pills and pop them on the way to school. I dropped acid whenever I could find it. In my town, and this was all in the mid-80s, so in my town you could get like a fifth of this cheap tequila for $6.51 and a hit of acid for $2, and a pack of cigarettes then was 96 cents. That's right. I'm old. Yes. So that's how I spent my allowance. I got like $10 a week, and that's what I tried to score when I could. I ended up secretly worried that I was doing some damage to myself. But it's nothing I would have admitted to you. I mean, when we were drinking, like, I was the guy who wanted to drink as much as there was to drink. However, I also had the ability somehow not... There were times, like, if we were, like, this many people at a party and there was a keg here, I would know intuitively that there was no chance that I was going to get enough alcohol with this many people and this much alcohol, that I would just not start drinking. Because what happens to me when I get one or two drinks in me is that I get a kind of a physical demand that's overpowering for more alcohol. And this persists, like, while I'm hammered. So, like, I'm coming out of blackouts somewhere trying to get drunker, trying to figure out where we left the other alcohol. Like, I can't be possibly drunker. Like, I can't even stand up. But what I'm obsessed with when I'm drunk is where's the rest of the alcohol. And so for me, if there's not enough around to start, it's too painful to have one or two and then go my merry way. Like, I know for some people that's enjoyable, but for me it's not. And so I would arrange my life to have this, like, once a month get drunk enough to lay down in a ditch somewhere and black out and stay out all night for a couple of nights. And so, like, on Friday afternoon, I would disappear from my mom's house, try to get some alcohol that night, and hopefully be out until Sunday afternoon, where I would come home and do my homework and try to make my life better or whatever for Monday at school. My mom ended up sick of it and threw me into a treatment center. I was sent there on October 9th of 1986. I was introduced that day. They gave me a strip search and a big book, and I count my sobriety from that day. Transformative experiences, I suppose. I was a few weeks before my 14th birthday. I was not the youngest kid in the treatment center. I was there against my will. And I really thought that they're going to find out here that I'm not that bad. I'm not nearly as bad as these other kids, and then they're gonna let me go, and I'll be... My mom won't be able to say shit when I go drinking again. Right? This was sort of my idea. And when the evaluation period was over, they told me three things about myself. They said, because of how much you drink when you drink, because of the violence that I would do when my mom would try to keep me from drinking, I would get extremely violent. So the violence and the fact that my family is just riddled with alcoholics and alcoholism on both sides. They said, like, those three things setting everything else aside, people who have those qualities, their drinking gets worse and never better. And I was stunned by that. And they had AA members that were coming into our treatment center and bringing us the message of AA. And one speaker came in a particular day, and he said many things, but in his qualification he said that he would have a particular feeling that when it would come on, he would know he was going to get drunk. And that's how I felt, like Friday afternoons, like when it was the right weekend. It's like everything's in place, it's on, you know. And that when that feeling would come over, alcohol was the only thing that would satiate it, right? And for me, it was a little bit more like I would have these feelings of, you know, like distance, right? Like, and we talk about this all the time in AA, like feelings of distance, of being different than. And I wasn't really the kind of kid who outwardly, like, wanted to be a part of. Like, I always wanted to be different. Like, being different is, like, in my generation, like, being different was the new belonging, kind of, you know? Like, it's like people were respected for how they were different. So I always wanted to be different. But I wanted to be valued for that difference, right? And like finding that sense of being valued was always so elusive. And that feeling, when it would come on, would send me up to the corner store, the liquor store in the strip mall, like in standing out there in the cold, waiting for someone who would come by for hours, you know, just hours and hours asking people if they would buy alcohol. You know, it's like not that many people in my town were willing to buy alcohol for a teenager in 1985 or 6. So I spent a lot of time with that terrible feeling, compelled out of the house to try to find alcohol. And when that feeling would come on really strongly, it's like alcohol was the only thing that could really take care of it. It's the only thing I'd ever found. And what this guy who came into the treatment center said, the AA member, he said that alcohol was the only thing he'd ever found to fix that feeling in him until he came to AA. And he said specifically the spiritual features of Alcoholics Anonymous turned out to be a better solution to that feeling that he had. So I was 13 years old in a treatment center. I heard that message of AA, and it sunk in. And I thought, oh my God, like, is it possible that this guy feels something similar to me? And is it possible that the thing that's worked for him could work for me? And that's the idea that got me sober. I went back to my hometown after the treatment thing got up, and I was, you know, taken to AA meetings by my mom at first, and I went into an AA that had no kids there, and I didn't really think I was alcoholic, but I was judging that mostly based on what other AA members said in meetings. So the meetings I used to go to, we'd get there a little early, and then all the old guys would sit around and like kind of do war story talk before the meeting started, you know, like, oh, I remember the time I did this, ha ha ha, oh, and then this guy one-ups him, and then that, and it's like this competition of who did the most terrible, hilarious thing, you know? And I didn't have any of those kinds of stories. And I felt like, shit, you know, like, I'm not one of these guys. Like, not yet. Like, I feel like I could be, you know? Like, anybody want to supply me with enough booze to get there, you know? Because it's hard to come by. But I didn't feel like I was the real thing, and so I kind of sat there quietly, worried. I looked around for a sponsor, and there wasn't much going on. I don't know back then if people were kind of afraid of young people in the AA. I mean, there was a young people's meeting in my hometown, don't get me wrong, right? Like, it was called Groovy Vibes. It met on Tuesdays, and I went there one time, and it was all these older people, you know? Like, I was, you know, I had turned 14 in the treatment center. You know, I showed up at the young people's meeting to find the other kids, and they're all adults, man. Like, these people all drive, you know? Like, these people don't live with their parents, you know? Like, those young people's meetings are for the birds, all these older people there. So for me, my experience is, like, the 18 and under thing was hugely different than the kind of 18 and over. It's like, being a minor to me felt like a completely different young people's experience. And so we started, like, after I had about 9 months sober, really just hanging around this local AA clubhouse, I would, like, go to school, right, like, go to ninth grade, take the bus to the local AA clubhouse, go to the 5:30 meeting, do my homework, go to the 8 o'clock meeting, play some ping pong, little Robotron, like a Robotron machine. And then... go ahead, look it up on the interweb. It's fine. It was fun. And then my mom would come pick me up at 10:30 from the AA clubhouse. Like, that was my day, right? So around that time, like around 9 months sober, these other kids started coming home from these treatment centers, and I started to have a few friends. And we were so kind of disgruntled by the young people's meeting being so old that we started having these private, like, high school-only step study meetings in each other's houses, you know? Super hardcore. I was never more rigid as an AA member as when I was new and young. let's see. But it worked. I stayed sober. I finally did get a real sponsor around the time I was 2 years sober. He took me through the steps as he'd been taken through, and it worked great. I did steps 1 to 9 with him, and then went off to college, and he kind of prepped me for 10, 11, and 12 as I went off to college. It was awesome. It was exactly what I needed, like to do all 12 steps and be finally kind of relieved of this this sort of terrible uncertainty about whether or not I belonged in AA. It's like finally the thing that convinced me that I was alcoholic enough for AA was the process of doing the 12 steps. It made me feel like I belonged and special at the same time, you know, which is what kind of the feeling that I'm always looking for. It's like to belong and yet feel special and sort of valued for what's unique about me. And my whole town of AA was like proud that they were sending this kid off to college. You know, it was like for them it was a success story too, that some kid made it and then got to go off and do this thing. And so I really felt fueled by them. I went off to college. I stayed sober. I had a great time in college. I loved college. I still sort of live like I'm in college. You know, it's like it's the best lifestyle going. You know, I graduated college. I went to Europe, traveled through Europe sober, went to meetings everywhere I went, got into grad school sober, did grad school sober, went to meetings all the time. I mean, I loved it. I mean, there was some young people stuff around, like conventions and stuff. I didn't really get too involved in it when I was actually a young person. I went to a few in Michigan. I went to my first Equipa was 1990 in Montreal. I went to 1992 in Cleveland. And I just thought it was complete jive, you know? It's like it was nonsense. I don't know. Yeah, it's like it didn't do much for me. And so I really spent most of my youth like kind of trying not to be known as young. And so when I moved to New York in like 98 after grad school and tried to pass. It was like I was finally old enough I could pass as a regular AA member. It's like in New York City, it's like if you're in your 20s, you can walk into any meeting and nobody's like, there's the young guy, you know? So it was great. It was anonymous. You know, if I didn't tell anybody that I was sober since I was a teenager, nobody knew. And it's not like I act that sober, right? So it's not like anyone was like, something about that guy. But AA has been great to me. It's given me a whole life. I guess I have a few minutes left that, like, whatever message, I guess, like, the one message that I have, of course, is just the fact of my life, which is that it's possible, right? It's possible. I mean, you guys are each also an example of that. It's possible, right? Like, you can do this. You can be very young, whatever your age is, whatever your situations are. You can get sober and stay sober. And I'm not, like, the oldest of the young people. There are people much older than me who got sober at my age or nearly my age. Who are sober much longer than I am. So those people are examples to me, as are each of you. So it's possible. I think the other thing that I'm really interested in today is I want to do all of AA, right? Like I mean, think about it, right? Like when I came into AA in 1986, there were a room like this full of people, right, who were all sober. So if all those people had stayed sober, there'd be as many people here with 24 years sober as there are each of you, right? Like, and then the same would be true for every year after that, right? If everybody who came today actually stayed sober, it would be unbelievably packed, right? So the clear evidence is that people leave AA. They must. I don't know where they go or what happens to them, but, you know, it's like I remember you guys because I see you. I have no idea who they are because they're not here, right? But my sense is, and this was true for me for a long time, that I think very few of us actually do all of AA. I don't do all of AA. I've done the 12 steps. the third tradition, maybe to keep some old guys off my back when I was young. Right? Seventh tradition, put a dollar in the basket if that's really working, the seventh tradition. Other than that, like, for most of my sobriety, I maybe did, what, like, 14 of these 36 things we have? Like, just a fraction of AA. And so I felt like AA only did a fraction for me of what it could do. And so these days, I feel like my message is, like, for myself only. Like, my imperative is, like, I want to do all of AA. I want to have the principles of the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts in my life. Like, I'm not perfect yet. I'm not there yet by any means, but I want to do that. And part of how I do that is I'm a member at a home group. I have sponsees that I take through the steps and the traditions and the concepts, and it helps me to do it with someone else. And then I take at least two service commitments outside of my home group at all times, one in the young people's community and one in general service. It's just what I do. And that gives me ample opportunity to work all 36 of these AA principles in my life. Without those service opportunities, I'm just not disciplined enough to do it. Anyway, you guys are like a beautiful audience. It's really nice to see you all. I'm honored to be here. I had a great, great time working with many of you with the IKIPAW committee this last year. It was an unbelievable experience for me to be a part of that. And so I just want to thank you all and hear what you have to say. Thanks.